The news coming out of Ferguson, Missouri over the last few days has been unsettling to say the least. It started when an unarmed black teenager was killed by a police officer. Then there were the protests that erupted into violence, and then the tear gas and rubber bullets unleashed to disperse the crowds. Meanwhile, the responses seem to come in multiple choice rather than essay form. Looting and rioting on the one hand, peaceful vigils and calls for civil discourse on the other. So what does this chain of events tell us about this moment in history? And is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change? I'm Gina Kaufman. Be a part of that conversation on Central Standard, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. Today's topic is a sensitive one. We're talking about responses to the shooting of an unarmed black teenager near St. Louis. Michael Brown was killed by a police officer. In the days that have passed since the young man's death, there has been an outcry in every imaginable forum. Vigils and protests, as well as riots and looting, a flood of editorials and grassroots social media movements, armored police vehicles, and heartfelt speeches. Last night at a community forum, Governor Jay Nixon said that in a country still struggling to overcome racial divisions, the shooting feels like, quote, an old wound torn fresh. Here to begin unpacking the chaos for us are historian Clarence Lang with us from the African American Studies Department at KU in Lawrence. Hi, Clarence.
Good morning.
And Toya Like Hayslip from the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UMKC. Good morning, Toya.
Good morning.
Today's conversation is inspired by a question. Is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change? And when we say change, we mean all kinds of change, from the personal to the social and political. Clarence Lang, I'm going to first get your answer to this question. But before we do that, could you tell us a little bit about your background? What did you study and what expertise do you bring?
I study African-American working class communities and social movements, specifically in St. Louis between the 1930s and the 1970s. And so Ferguson, Missouri municipalities around St. Louis City fall within my general bailiwick.
Sort of incredible that you happen to have studied St. Louis in particular. What led you to the study of St. Louis?
I grew up in Chicago. But I found myself living in St. Louis, in the St. Louis area, rather, when I was working on my MA thesis. And I actually got politically involved in a community organization in that city. And I became interested in wanting to know more about the history of that community, the history of previous social movements that happened in that city as a way of kind of understanding my own self in that context. And so that's how I initially became interested in St. Louis. But in the context of doing the study, I came to appreciate St. Louis and Missouri more generally as an important laboratory of historical trends, of race relations in the United States, that in fact, St. Louis, Missouri became, for me, embodied a merger of trajectories of traditions that were both Southern, but also Midwestern. So to summarize, St. Louis was a convenient site of study, given where I was located. But I also came to appreciate how much a place like St. Louis in Missouri can tell us about the United States more generally.
That's interesting. You know, we've dealt with in the past, in the very recent past, in fact, news of incidents that have some things in common with the one in Ferguson, but in Los Angeles or Florida or coastal places. And what do you think it means to you that maybe is in some way different that it to see it happen in St. Louis, in Missouri?
Well, if we make the connections between today and, for example, the 1960s, and we have to be careful how we do that. But in fact, the 1960s, between 1964 and 1968, during the summers, a lot of urban areas went up in flames. There were disturbances that happened during that period. And we think of Watts. We might think of Detroit. We might think of Newark. But in fact, there's been work done that suggests that most of those disturbances actually occurred in the Midwest. They weren't always as major as in Newark or as in Detroit, but in fact, there were more of them in regions like Missouri, mid-sized, small communities. And so, in fact, Ferguson, what it represents, is actually indicative of broader patterns.
Well, Clarence, I want to talk to you about those broader patterns eventually, but first, let me get your answer to this question. What came to your mind when we asked you, is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change?
That's a big question. I think there are a number of things that occurred, and in some ways I'll speak a little bit outside of my bailiwick, but I do think that given social policies over the past 20, 30 years, one of the things that we've seen is obviously mass incarceration, the growth of a prison population, the majority of whom are people of color. And I think one of the things that's occurred alongside of that has been what I would call, and other scholars might call, mass criminalization. So if you are a person of color, whether you have a record or not, whether you've been in trouble with the law or not, in some ways your status is determined, maybe not determined, but your status is certainly impacted, is affected by this phenomenon of mass incarceration and the kind of perceptions that creates about young people of color.
When you say your status, what exactly do you mean by that?
So I would argue that we're in a period where there is a casual assumption between black bodies and communities and criminality. And so for example, someone walking to his grandmother's or someone walking to and from a convenience store can become, and unfortunately in too many people's minds, indicative of crime. That person is possibly in the act of some imminent act of crime. So that's what I mean, that the status, that there's an assumption that the normal state for young people of color is one of engaging in crime.
And so this affects your perception of what would be considered change that would need to be affected.
Absolutely. That I think that I mean, and certainly mass incarceration, my colleague can speak more about this, obviously, but mass incarceration in some way stems from the war on drugs. And that was approached as a war. And so I think one of the consequences is, I mean, we've seen the militarization of police. We've seen these very aggressive policing tactics. We've seen the gutting of Fourth Amendment protections of unreasonable search and seizure. And in the same way, if you'll permit me to make a parallel, in the context of slavery, for example, and I want to be careful not to say these are not the same things, but in the context of slavery, all African-Americans were not slaves, but all slaves were black. And so even if you were a free African-American, how you were treated in the general society was impacted by the fact that most black people were slaves. I think there's an analogy that we can make, that even if you're law-abiding, even if you are, as in the case of Michael Brown, you were college-bound, your the ways in which that you are perceived, your status in some ways is shaped by the fact that we have 2.3 million people who are incarcerated, most of whom are black and brown people, and the assumptions that are made about normal, quote unquote, normal black behavior.
So what changes this?
I mean, I think that we see perhaps some movement. I think that these very austere, mandatory sentencing policies around nonviolent drug offenses. And let me be clear, black people don't use or sell drugs more than any other group. So I want to be clear right off the bat. But I think that our policies that have led us to this point in terms of this rapid, very obscene growth of a prison population, I think that's a starting point.
So working toward policy change.
Toward policy, I think that also has to affect how our policing agencies are socialized, that to take seriously this idea of serving and protecting, and in terms of how people are trained, moving away from this idea that your job is to surveil, to watch over, to assume that citizens who are minding their business are in the act of some crime simply because they've left their homes. So I think at those two levels, that's a beginning point. There certainly has to be policy, I think.
Toya Like Hayslip, let's turn to you. What is your background? You're a professor of criminology and criminal justice at UMKC, but tell us about your specific area of interest.
Okay, well, I guess broadly, I would be considered a victimologist. I'm a criminologist who studies victimization patterns and trends, but understanding that victimization is just one side of the crime coin, right? You have offending on one end, victimization on the other. So very broadly, I'm passionate about victimization and victimization of people of color, given we over-focus on, in my mind, people of color's experiences as offenders. So that broadly is it, but I look at structural issues, contextual issues, and situational antecedents, sort of like what we're talking about today, that shape the occurrence of violent encounters. So my recent research really looks at sort of interlocking inequalities of race, gender, class, social status, as it relates to violent encounters between individuals, sort of like very much so like what's happening right now with this case in Ferguson. So
what were your thoughts when we asked you today's question? Is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change?
Well, I agree with my colleague wholeheartedly that we have to do it on two fronts, right? It has to be a policy, a conscientious policy that is rooted and grounded in addressing issues of race. So in terms of the war on drugs and particularly the war on crack cocaine, that individuals certainly were not guided by racism per se, in that they were, I think, essentially, in an altruistic sense, trying to be race blind. But we still have to be race conscious, right? That racism is so entrenched in our society that we cannot be totally blind to it and say, well, all things are equal now, right? But we certainly have to be more sensitive and race conscious of these sort of policy decisions that have clear implications on racial divides in terms of mass incarceration, class divides in terms of, again, mass incarceration. So on that level, I agree. You know, we absolutely have to have some policy changes. I also agree with my colleague in that certainly we cannot underscore enough how individuals who are leaving their homes are viewed as criminal because we've made given those large-scale policies, we've made race synonymous with crime, in that individuals don't just see race. They see age, they see gender, they see class. So let's use the case in Sanford, Florida, for instance. You know, if the victim in that situation were a 90-year-old man, that probably would not have happened the way it did.
So you're saying that in the Trayvon Martin case,
sure,
that age was a factor.
Absolutely,
in addition
a factor.
To race.
Some even blamed his hoodie, right, as an indicator, which was an indicator of status, that he was an inner city kid, perhaps, right. So we make these assumptions across all these dimensions, not just one, but all of them. So these inequalities interlock to sort of allow for perceptions of an individual as threatening, right? But the individual who's engaging in that violent encounter, let's use George Zimmerman, he's also assessing his own vulnerabilities to that dangerousness, right? Given his race, his gender, his class, his social status. So we can't detach them. So this police officer involved shooting, law enforcement are tasked with this really great burden of serving and protecting. And unlike any other agent of social control, they're the only ones given the authority to use lethal force in enforcing the law. So on one end, you know, they're held to a very high standard and given a large amount of discretion, but they are still susceptible to the same pressures and dynamics as the rest of us. So
there are a couple things I want to run past you. One is, I don't know if you've seen this social media response, which is a hashtag, if they gunned me down. Have you seen that?
I have.
It's so maybe first I'll have you explain what it is and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Well, again, it's kind of tied to the things that I was just speaking on, that individuals in terms of, so we were talking about these massive kind of changes that can happen in terms of public policy, but then in terms of our day-to-day interactions with each other, right, that we're using these systematic issues of race, gender, class to sort of explain how we interact with one another. And so that from the perspective of young African Americans, that if they gun me down, that that is a reality day-to-day for us.
So there are a lot of people on social media, African Americans in our communities, who are posting two images of themselves. One that's what they that's an image often you'll see like a with a graduation cap or something like that, or with family. And then the other is an image that a lot of young people might take, looking kind of like posturing or cool or something. And the question is, if they gunned me down, which image would the media use? Are media portrayals of black males part of what people are trying to change?
It's going to have to happen in terms of those micro level changes, media changes. It's going to have to happen in terms of how we, again, really make efforts to be race conscious, not race blind, or gender conscious. You know what I mean? Across all of these intersections. So, again, I think that if we're looking for a one point kind of solution, it's going to have to be holistic. It's going to happen on the micro level. It's going to have to happen on the individual level as well. So those social media depictions are really just looking at how we are perceived as dangerous, and that I'm the same person, regardless of whichever photo you see me in, if they gun me down. But how does the wider world see me, right? And this is, it's a way of taking back agency and self-awareness that I am a person, but I'm not one-dimensional, I'm multidimensional. But also I think we have to, the other part of that I think is so critical, Jean, is that we have to consider how individuals who might act in ways that we perceive as, or we broadly see as wrong, you know, law enforcement officers, George Zimmerman and his idea of protecting his neighborhood, that they're assessing their own vulnerabilities to those dangers as well.
Since you are an expert in criminal justice, there's a quote from an editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that I'd like to run past you. This editorial ran on August 11th, and it starts this way. Michael Brown didn't get due process. The still unnamed police officer who shot the 18-year-old black teenager dead in Ferguson will get plenty of it. This is at the root of the frustration that is driving the African-American community to the streets in North St. Louis County over yet another senseless killing of a young black man. This idea of due process being uneven, I'd like to get you two responding to that. Do you think that that is at the root of what you're seeing happening in Ferguson right now?
Absolutely, right. That you know, while I certainly appreciate, you know, these calls both within and outside of the black community for peaceful demonstration, I and one that I would absolutely agree with, I also understand the non-peaceful or the rioting behaviors, given the lack of equal protection under the law, right? That individuals, based on where they are situated within our society, their social positions in the world, if you have been so restricted or shut out of these legitimate recourses to deal with anger and frustration following these incidents, we should expect rioting. It's no different than from what we saw in a historical context, and my colleague can absolutely speak to that. But we should also expect those more peaceful demonstrations from individuals who do have agency, you know, that are the middle class, that do have more access.
Man, I think that police community encounters is simply the tip of the iceberg, to take off on that point. And if you'll permit me to go back in terms of references to the 1960s, we're not in the 1960s, but I think that there are some things that are instructive from that period. So I've been thinking a lot about the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, known as the Kerner Commission, a report that was issued in 1968 to figure out what was the cause of a wave of urban disturbances that had happened in 1967. And what people found was that even though the spark of these disturbances in pretty much every case was some act of violent encounter between police and black citizens, underneath all of this lay a number of social and economic issues in terms of people not feeling that that public representatives represent them, grievances around employment, housing, education, people feeling that the opportunities for meaningful opportunity and mobility were not there. And so cut off from these opportunities to express themselves through, you know, perhaps more wholesome means that people resorted to the tools that they felt they had to them. And I think we can make the parallel between that particular context and what we're dealing with in Ferguson, Missouri today. That at the end of the day, that there are a number of things that have to be addressed.
Well, we are going to get right back to this conversation after a short break. You're listening to Central Standard. We want to hear from you, too. Is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. And when we say change, we mean all kinds of change. The number to call, again, 816-235-2888.
This is KCUR 89.3 FM, online at kcur.org. Coming up on Here and Now, a new drug-resistant superbug is skyrocketing in hospitals in the Southeast, and it kills almost half of those who get it. We'll learn more on Here and Now between noon and 2 on KCUR. And then during Here and Now on Marketplace at 12:30, the Marketplace Tech Report, the news editor of the online blog Jezebel talks about the challenges presented when online commenting turns abusive. That's on the Marketplace Tech Report at 12:30 during Here and Now here on KCUR. Central Standard is made possible in part by the 35th Annual Ethnic Enrichment Festival, inviting you to feel the world beat in the heart of America with food, crafts, music, and dance. More information from more than 60 countries. That's August 15th through the 17th. More information online at eekc.net. It's 1026, 75 degrees in Midtown, Kansas City. This is KCUR and kcur.org, a service of UMKC.
Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. We've been talking this morning with Clarence Lang, a professor of African American Studies at KU, and Toya Like Hayslip, a professor of criminal justice at UMKC. And we have been talking about the events in Ferguson, Missouri right now, a town near St. Louis where real serious unrest has been unleashed since the shooting by a police officer of an unarmed black teenager. We would love to hear from you, 816-235-2888. The question we are asking is there a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change? We've seen a lot of debate about the proper way of responding, from the more violent reactions to the peaceful protest, the voices that are expressing calls for nonviolence. And our guests today, we're just talking about historical context, and I'd like to get back to that. But I also want to mention that both of you have lived in St. Louis. St. Louis is so nearby that it might be easy to assume that we know this terrain. But is there anything about St. Louis or Ferguson that you think it's important for our listeners to understand?
Okay. Well, being a native of St. Louis, I think one of the things that I would love for our listeners to take away is that it's a neighborhood in transition, right? These were your first residential escapes from the city as sort of the growth of inner cities were happening in northern cities across the nation. So in many ways, it's a defended neighborhood in that. So you should expect to see these social control, you know, kind of tightening of policing happening. But it's also a transitioning neighborhood given racial turnover of those neighborhoods, if you look at it historically. So it went from being a primarily white middle working class neighborhood to a black working class middle class neighborhood very quickly.
And what's important about that point, I think, is that particularly, I mean, Ferguson is also what you would call an inner ring suburb. And we see this around the nation that, in fact, part of the white flight actually included the flight of capital as well. And so in many cases, what we're talking about is a community that in some respects has been economically abandoned over the long term. I've read some figures that suggest about a fourth of the population there lives below poverty. And so in terms of the kind of frustrations that people and grievances that people have, and we have to understand that's a foundation of this. And encounters with law enforcement are simply a spark that ignite, if you will, frustrations that have been festering around a broad range of issues. And I think a key thing to keep in mind, too, is that St. Louis, and I grew up in Chicago. So this might sound strange coming from me because Chicago is a very racially segregated city. But that entire St. Louis metropolitan area, I mean, St. Louis pioneered in forms of residential segregation. And it's no surprise that a number of key Supreme Court rulings about fair housing come out of cases in or around St. Louis. But of course, patterns of that have continued. So we're dealing with grievances around, you know, economic deprivation, but also there's a concentration of poverty and people are socially isolated as well.
And my dissertation research was on racial and economic segregation in these communities. And Kansas City was one of the cities that I looked at. And St. Louis, both from a professional and a personal standpoint, is a highly segregated city, as is Kansas City. Kansas City is unique in that truce. Rarely do you see an actual street be a dividing line like that. And city planners purposely set it that way. And so, you know, as my colleague was saying, you know, Ferguson is one of those first residential escapes that now is turned over really rapidly.
Let's go ahead and bring it to Kansas City a little bit. I mean, Kansas City, St. Louis is so nearby. Are you surprised that things have been so quiet here when a city so close to us is there? We're seeing so much and there's something almost bordering on silence here. It's a stark contrast.
I actually equate it to, when I'm asked these questions broadly about crime, I equate it to sort of the after effects, aftershock of following an earthquake, that it would happen in your more traditional, you know, historic industrial cities like Detroit, St. Louis, et cetera, and then some not necessarily geographically smaller, but smaller places like Kansas City. You would expect that to happen a little bit after that.
I don't know how to add to that. I mean, I think if your question is why haven't there been disturbances, if I understand you
well,
correctly.
Well, not necessarily even just disturbances, that there doesn't seem to be much of a visible response of any kind. People talking on social media that there is a vigil planned for tomorrow. But so far, we just really haven't seen a lot at all.
I think there are two responses. I think on the one hand, and I'll speak a little bit personally, The aftermath of the George Zimmerman verdict last summer left me and a number of people that I spoke to stunned. And I think in the wake of that, we've had a number of different instances in Arizona, New York City, L.A. And I don't know if I think that you have some areas where people are mobilized and the grievances are very raw and at the surface. But I think you have other cases where people are simply, I think, stunned. And I think that sometimes you can get, for lack of a better word, punch drunk. And I think that there are a lot of conversations going on. And I find in a number of these conversations, people don't always quite know what to do. But people are discussing it. I mean, these conversations are occurring in informal spaces, even if people don't know at a broader macro level. How do you begin to address these issues?
And there is a vigil, if you will, that will be happening here in Kansas City. So I agree with my colleague wholeheartedly. Again, it's sort of like this aftershock of a major earthquake. These major cities are impacted or they're doing something major and then, boom, it happens in other places as well, but on a smaller scale.
Well, we asked our callers to join in the conversation, so I'm going to go ahead and bring them in on this discussion. Let's talk to Rick. Hi, Rick. Okay, Rick was not there, so we will turn instead to Babs in Overland Park. Hi, Babs. Okay, we won't talk to them. Instead,
we'll talk to Babs.
Well, we will go ahead and continue the discussion amongst ourselves. Something else I wanted to ask about is that we've been talking about response, but what about prevention? Because in some ways, every response seems to fall short after a fatal shooting because nothing can undo what has happened to that individual. Someone has died. Prevention is really the only thing that can make the difference between life and death. So thinking forward into the future, what can prevent things like this?
This is such a tough conversation for me because, I mean, the questions are so big and so overwhelming. And perhaps my colleague is better trained in sort of addressing this. But, I mean, I think that I'll start by saying one of the things that we do know is that Missouri keeps very good records, for example, on the race of people who are stopped. And so we have evidence, we have data that tells us that in the state and in communities like Ferguson, there's a very consistent pattern of people of color being stopped, and there's no contraband that's found, but that pattern continues. And so it just seems to me that our conversations have to move beyond the data to some real, if you will, soul-searching conversations about, okay, now that we have the data, now that we know that these things, that this is not a figment of anyone's imagination, that this exists, how do we develop the political will to actually address this? And again, I'm going to stress at a level of policy, that there have to be incentives, there have to be disincentives for this kind of behavior. And I want to be careful. I don't want to indict any law enforcement officer. This thing is still ongoing, so I don't want to sort of assume. But we do have a pattern of racial profiling in the state and in Ferguson, Missouri. And that has to be addressed. Until that is addressed, then the kind of distrust that people have of law enforcement and the kind of responses that we see, I would like to be wrong, but I mean, we leave ourselves in the same situation.
Let's try again to talk with Babs in Overland Park. Hi, Babs. Okay. Toya, for you, you're an expert in criminal justice, so you might bring some real knowledge about what police are dealing with, because I think people have a great deal of understanding of what the communities are feeling, even if it's just an imagined kind of empathy. Is there something that we should understand better about police and their work and how they do what they do?
Sure. I think the biggest problem has been this divide, right, that the community is talking on one level. Law enforcement is tasked with particular responsibilities, and law enforcement officers in particular have the primary duty of enforcing the law. And that being said, are held to a higher level, a higher standard, given that they're the only ones that can use force and lethal force in doing that job, right? So you could be condemned to death via a jury or a judge. They can't put you to death right then and there, you know, to kind of put it really simply. Law enforcement officers can, and for obvious reasons. I agree, again, that I've had the great fortune of working as an evaluator on several projects, local as well as some that are based on national initiatives, and to see sort of what I've seen happen, and I hope could affect change, is this merging of those entities, that you cannot have a law enforcement response that's free of community. You can't have a community response that's free of law enforcement. The problem is that they have been so polarized, and you have to figure out a way. And it doesn't happen overnight. It has to happen, you know, really purposively and continually over time. Again, that idea of being race conscious, not race blind. And so, you know, again, not to sort of shout out any particular program, but I think KC Nova, in terms of its ideal, is centered on just that. It is.
Can you explain the program for those who might not be familiar?
It's the approach on the surface is to bring together law enforcement, the community, social services of various sectors together to address violence in Kansas City, and in particular serious violent crime. So the goal is to do that. Now, absolutely doing it and implementing it, that's challenging, but it's not impossible. And so that I think those sorts of initiatives are going to be key. Let's take it on a micro level to the situation happening in St. Louis right now. You don't want just a law enforcement response. You don't want just a community response. If those entities could come together on a unified front, that's going to be the most effective, just based on my personal and professional experience.
When you see people responding to this, you were mentioning before that your field of study is that you study minorities as victims of crime because there's so much attention given to minorities as perpetrators of crime. This idea that the same person can be perceived by different communities as either a victim or a perpetrator is really at the forefront of what we're talking about. Can you talk about how that applies to this specific case a little bit?
Sure. I mean, and it applies to, again, the case that we saw in Florida, the case that we saw recently in New York. It is the role of intersecting, interlocking inequalities that impact the likelihood of a violent encounter, right? And that they are rooted in these systematic you know, roots of racism, sexism, you know, all of the isms, if you will.
We will be coming right back to this conversation after a short break on Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Our guests are going to stick around for us through this break, and we will rejoin our phone lines when we return. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Clarence Lang, a professor of African and African American Studies at KU, and Toya Like Hayslip, professor of criminal justice and criminology at UMKC. And we are talking with you, our listeners, about whether there is a way of responding to police shootings that can affect change. We've got some callers ready to weigh in on this, and we're going to go ahead and turn to them. Let's talk with Jason in Kansas City. Hi, Jason.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great. How about you?
I'm great. I actually grew up in St. Louis and in that particular area of the town. And I think the prevention for it ever happening or to just improve conditions is basically there's no jobs. There's no jobs, housing, and just all the other social effects that happened in the black community that has not changed probably in the last 20 years and have probably gotten worse. So until there's a way of improving what's happening in the black community, whether we're in St. Louis or Kansas City or any other black community, jobs and homes and socioeconomic changes has to happen
okay.
in order to prevent these things to happen.
And I want to get our guests to weigh in on this, because this idea that people have to be on some level enfranchised in a system to want to protect it, to want to maintain the peace within it.
I go back to the Kerner Commission. This is exactly part of the recommendations that came out of that. And before I forget, I think that probably one of the things that should be put on the table is that I think that the makeup of law enforcement agencies, this matters as well. And I want to be careful that, part of it is that in Ferguson, you have, 50-odd police officers, only three of whom are African-American. And so that has to be part of the solution as well. I mean, even though understanding that by itself, simply making the police law enforcement agencies more representative of the communities that they serve, that is a necessary component, though, of course, it's not by itself sufficient. It's about training. It's about the relationships between law enforcement and the community. So I just wanted to make sure to say that as well, because I think that's part of the problem occurring in places, communities like Ferguson, Missouri, and St. Louis County.
Toya, do you want to weigh in on this?
Sure. I mean, as my colleague said, it has to be symbolic and substantive changes, right? And part of that is making sure that department looks representative of the community that it serves. But that these individuals, when you think about the first families that were moving there following white flight from even those areas, these were your upwardly mobile African-American families. And so they were entrenched, and the individuals there are entrenched without the resources now and via employment, education to become entrenched. And so you've got these combating forces happening there.
Let's talk to James in Independence. Hi, James.
Hello. My question is, why every time a cop kills somebody or injures them and fires his weapon, he's immediately put on paid administrative leave? To me, that's shoot somebody, get a vacation. Why not, as soon as he fires his weapon, he's unemployed until it is proven justified?
I mean, I'll start by saying, I think we want to be careful. I take the caller's sentiments. But if we're serious about due process, then I would argue that has to apply to the law enforcement officer. In other words, I mean, we want to uphold the principle that people should be innocent until proven guilty. The tragedy, of course, and again, I take the caller's point, the tragedy, of course, as you mentioned, Gene, when you were reading the editorial from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, is that this young man, Michael Brown, will not have due process. But that should nevertheless exist for the officer involved. That's my position, at least.
Let's turn to Walter in Kansas City. Hi, Walter.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to make a comment. I kind of got in on the conversation late, but I heard the young lady is speaking say something about the reaction of the community, how they rebel, and other elements more vested in the community have a different way of reacting, but they react nevertheless, and she was giving legitimacy to both. And I wanted to make this comment in terms of analysis. I'm old enough to remember the late 60s and early 70s. And there were a lot of rebellions going on in black communities across the country, like she said, most of them as a result or reaction to police violence. And the number of rebellions was constant, and it was every summer, seems like. And the federal government, in terms of response, came in with job training programs. They had in Kansas City City Neighborhood Youth Corps. They had model cities. I have a friend who got convicted of a crime early in life, and right after he came out of jail, he got into a job training program. He's a journeyman carpenter. He said they have nothing like that for young people today. So my point is, people always say no violence, peace. Well, that's good and well and done when it's black people responding to violence, but it seems like that's the only thing that the system responds in a positive and in a forthright manner to. That's my opinion.
Absolutely. I think, again, for the people who are the truly disadvantaged, as William Julius Wilson would say, their only agency is to use public outcry as in that format, because they do not have the social capital and power, you know, that others, even middle class black people, have access to in order to have their voices be heard. So I agree wholeheartedly with the caller.
This is in some ways, I think, part of what we're seeing is a retreat of people responsible for social policy from the concept of social welfare. So between the 30s and the 1960s, there was an emphasis on the idea that government actually had a positive role to play in society to help create a basement below which people were not allowed to fall. And I think one of the things that we've seen at the macro level since the 1970s, certainly since the 1980s, is a move away from that idea, right? So the mantra is that government can't do anything right and shouldn't do anything, that people should be on their own, they should pull themselves up. And the emphasis has turned, unfortunately, to punishment. And so I think at the broadest level, that's a war of ideas that we have to begin to wage, that in fact, government has a responsibility to see to it that people are well-housed, that they have nutrition, that they have meaningful economic opportunities, which is very different from the period that the caller is referring to.
And what about this idea that I thought I heard Walter expressing, that calls for nonviolence need to apply to both sides of this violence, that it can't just be the community that hears this request?
I would agree with that. I mean, everything he said, I would agree with. I mean, as someone who studies social movements, so I do have to say that while these disturbances then and now come from a very legitimate place, in the long term, there has to be political organization and mobilization. That simply disturbances, rebellions, riots, whatever word you want to use, that's not a sustainable political strategy, I think, even though they come from a very real place.
Let's talk to Richard. Hi, Richard.
Yes, good morning. I'm enjoying your program very much. I came in late, but I appreciate the salient points brought up by your callers as well as your guests. However, and maybe this is because I came in late, the thing that strikes me, and I'm speaking from perspective of being a first-generation Asian American who's been to 45 countries in the world and chose to come to the United States rather than any other country, including my home country, is that we're talking a lot about what happened in Ferguson and elsewhere from a racial point of view as well as an economic point of view. I think at times we're just too quick to pull the racial card out, and we need to put that last at the bottom of the deck. We need to look at all of the facts and not rush to judgment.
Let's go ahead and hear some response to that.
I agree with the caller in that in an ideal United States of America, that would absolutely happen, right? I think that many people feel that way, you know, that we should be a race-blind country and that we are a country of immigrants. But that just has not been the case historically and certainly not contemporarily. Race is going to rear its head in these issues. And I also just want to kind of point out, you know, given his station as an Asian American male, that, I mean, demographers have shown this time and time again, Latinos who are fluent in terms of English language, the same for Asians who are fluent in terms of English language, their assimilation into our society in a very positive way is much more likely than it is for even African Americans. So, again, we want to leave it, but we can't.
I mean, I take his point about, and I mean, we come back to the point of due process. I mean, I believe that we do want to be careful that we don't sort of try and, you know, indict and try, you know, a particular officer involved. I think the problem with the problem here, though, is that we have data that tells us that black people in Ferguson, black people in Missouri are more likely to be stopped. And it's not as if that they are being found with various kinds of contraband any more than any other groups. In fact, right, there's some evidence to suggest that officers are likely to find it among white people that they stop. And so that's the inconvenient fact here that we have to address.
Well, if you had the ability to speak directly to the people in Ferguson right now who are so upset, what would you say to them?
I would say organize, organize, organize. Think about how the institutions that exist there can be used to mobilize not simply around this tragedy, but around the underlying issues that made this tragedy possible. And if there aren't institutions that exist to do it, create them.
Thanks so much to today's guest for this conversation and to our callers. There were so many that we just ran out of time to get to, but we're going to have to wrap things up now. Clarence Lang, African and African American Studies professor at KU, thank you. And Toya Like Hayslip from UMKC's Criminology and Criminal Justice Department, it's been an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a visit to the Missouri River where intrepid paddlers are setting out on a voyage. Right now, at this very moment, about 200 people are boating toward St. Louis on the Missouri River. It's the 9th annual MR340 River Race, and these adventurers will travel 340 miles in less than 88 hours. Our intern, Matt Hodapp, was there for the launch yesterday at dawn.
The early morning sun shimmered across the still water of the Missouri River as racers shook with anticipation at the starting line of the MR340. Then, it started.
8, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is one of the top 100 National Geographic adventures in a lifetime. I mean, to be able to paddle from, you know, 340 miles from Kansas City to St. Charles, Missouri, it's the world's longest nonstop river race. And to be able to do that and say that you completed it is pretty awesome.
This exciting launch from Call Point has changed a lot since the first year of the race, when there were only 11 people. Scott Mansker, the creator of the MR340, still remembers when he was inspired to start the ultramarathon race.
Well, I had been paddling on the Missouri River for a long time, and I never saw any other paddlers out there.
But Mansker had heard of other marathon races in other parts of the country.
And I thought, man, why isn't there anything like that here? Because our venue is even better. And, you know, you can only go so long thinking, man, I wish somebody would put something on like this before you just realize maybe we're the ones who have to put this on.
The MR340 now draws hundreds of participants from all over the world, paddling in a wide variety of boats. One of these racers from Kansas City, Doug Jennings, has done the race for a number of years. In 2010, he completed the race in a dragon boat with 19 other people.
It's pretty difficult just with two people in a boat being in there for 50 hours, let alone trying to get 20 people on a boat that had never met each other. So we didn't know if anyone's going to be thrown overboard before we hit the finish line or anything, but we made it. We finished third overall, and we got the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest distance traveled in a dragon boat.
One of the most unpredictable and fearsome forces that boaters face is the weather. But that doesn't always mean storms. Even a peaceful fog can cause all sorts of trouble out on the water.
There was around 2 feet of fog on the river. It was around 1 o'clock in the morning. And we were on the channel side of the river. And all of a sudden we heard a rushing sound, which was the water going over the wing dikes that protrude out of the side of the river. And we hit that and it spun our boat around. And we were literally hanging on by one rock, tilted at like a 45-degree angle. And we had to wait. We ended up calling the rescue boats, and we had to wait 4 hours.
Racers traversing the river have more than just wing dikes to worry about. Sometimes other obstacles can get in the way of the finish line. The
first year I did it, a couple got ran over by a barge right outside Jefferson City. It was foggy. The barge came up behind them and ran them over, and they got sucked under the barge, and barge is able to pull them out to safety. And you know, they had a couple of scratches and bruises, you know, and they made it.
They survived.
Yeah.
Amongst all the danger and adventure, boaters on the MR340 often find moments of serenity out on the river where they can bond and get to know each other.
That's the longest part of the race is when you hit nighttime, like from like 11 o'clock at night to 5 in the morning. Everything gets still, and you know, time just like almost stops out there. So when you're out there paddling and people are talking and telling stories and everything, it just helps the time go away. And that was, that's the fun part, just, you know, getting to meet new people that are out there doing the same thing you are and hearing their stories.
The race was actually postponed from its original date in June. But organizer Scott Mansker says that these new dates will offer participants a celestial light show.
The Perseid meteor shower is supposed to be really active the first 2 nights of the race. And so we've never done the race during the Perseid shower before. And so that's going to be really neat. The nights are beautiful out there. I mean, you know, you think you can see the stars in Kansas City, but you really can't. Once you're out in the middle of nowhere on the Missouri River, the sky is just this huge, gorgeous palette of stars. And then to see, like, hunks of burning rock flying through it all night, I just can't wait to see what that's going to be like.
Hopefully, the weather will be clear tonight, so the racers on the MR340 can enjoy that meteor shower as they row down the river.
That story was brought to us by Matt Hodapp. We'll be catching up with Doug Jennings and another racer to find out how it went next week on Central Standard. That's it for today's show. To listen back to our conversation about the response to a police shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about tomatoes, why they cost what they cost, and what to do with a good one no matter how much you spent on it. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date. That's coming right up next.